Hello, everybody, and good evening, and welcome to Patriotic Weekly Review, episode number 295. And I'm live tonight with my wonderful guest on DLive, Odyssey, Rumble, and Entropy. And the first thing I'm going to ask you, and I'm going to ask him, please share all the links. Please share the Odyssey and Rumble links, especially. Make sure they're out there, people, because this is going to be a big show. Well, hopefully it's going to be a big show. I'm really looking forward to it. And I'll be introducing my guests soon, but please share those links. Now, I've got lots of things planned later for this week. Now, the first thing I've got planned is my appearance on Friday with Dr. David Duke. I've also got a pre-recorded video coming out on Friday. And my pre-recorded video is about some news that broke on the 4th of January that British birth rates have dipped to an all-time low of just 1.44 children per woman. And this is a sort of a record low. And it's one that newspapers and press agencies are saying Britain simply can't recover from. And I've done a video and it's called Abundance and Falling Birth Rates. And basically it's about how I think the capitalist system got people hooked on hedonism and materialism, and that although it increased our quality of life, it sort of got us hooked on this cycle of wanting more and desiring materialistic wealth and desiring sort of more hedonistic activities. And people now have consciously decided not to have children. And I know that people are less fit and having fewer children because of fertility issues. That's become more common. But most people who don't have children, it's a conscious choice. And it's a longer video than usual. I've been scripting it today. It's about 3,000 words already. But it's something a bit different. And I hope you guys enjoy it. And when I say it's something a bit different, I mean none of you are going to watch it. And it'll get about 200 views. But yeah, I put a lot of effort into it. So, you know, when I'm watching that view counter go up by 2 views a day, I'll be hating myself for putting so much effort into it. So, yeah, that's something not to look forward to. Anyway, I'll be with David Duke also on Friday afternoon, so we'll see how that goes. And Sunday afternoon, I might be doing Film Club, but I'm not sure about that because I've got something else cooking that might keep me busy all Sunday. So I'll get back to you on that one. But if you're jonesing for some lighthearted entertainment, you can check out last Sunday's Nationalist A-Team stream, where you can see me carrying Natty and the Patriot as we play PUBG. They get repeatedly killed, and I mop up all the serious players myself before eventually getting killed and then losing my temper. So that's entertaining. Now, if you like this show, and if you like all my other shows, please do consider super chatting. Please do consider making a contribution. Now, obviously, we're live tonight and we've got an amazing guest. So if you want to help these shows, if you like these shows, if you like supporting my work, the work I do for Patriotic Alternative and all the streams and other things I do, please consider making a small donation. Remember, nothing I do ever goes behind a paywall. So please consider giving something, $3, $5, $10, whatever you can afford. It'd be much appreciated. And, you know, we'll read out any questions, comments and super chats in the second hour of the show. Now, you can also send all your crypto beans to me. Crypto's going through the roof, so you can share those magic beans with me at all the links in the description below. And if you want to speak to me about anything, you can write to me about anything you want, really. And people do, and I answer my emails on a daily basis. So you can write to me at mark@thefallofwesternman.com, and I'd be more than happy to reply and help you with anything you need help with. And I generally spend a lot of my day doing that. That's the kind of thing I do. A lot of the day counseling people, helping people with legal problems that they may have encountered for espousing their opinions in the workplace or at a college or school or anything like that. I do all kinds of things. So if you need help, I'm the man to come to. Anyway, enough has been said already, and we still haven't introduced this amazing guest. Now, he's a new guest to this show. He's a bit of a smaller content creator, doesn't have many followers on Twitter, you know, nothing on YouTube, tiny guy. So I thought I'd give him a bit of a leg up tonight, and hopefully we can get him a few followers. Obviously, I'm being sarcastic. This is one of the biggest guests I've had on. It's iHypocrite. He's got an amazing Twitter account with an incredible 600,000 followers, 100,000 followers on YouTube. This guy's a legend. His tweets go viral all the time. His content's brilliant. And he's always been very kind to me and has repeatedly invited me on his Murdoch sort of reunion streams where we go through old episodes of Murdoch Murdoch and laugh at the good times, laugh at the times of 2016 when we were all happy, all on YouTube, and none of us were being shadowed by counter-terrorism officers for simply having a different opinion. What a world that was. Anyway, here is the man himself, the living legend. How are you doing, my friend? I hope you had a wonderful Christmas and New Year, and it's great to have you on.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks, Mark. It's my pleasure. I've been following your work for years and years and years, and love what you do. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. Well, I love what you do, and I wish I could be there to share it and revel in it, but I'm not because I'm banned on Twitter. Now, you've got a huge Twitter account.
We're going to get your Twitter account back. I know the UK government is probably not trying to stand in the way, but we're gonna make it happen.
It would be wonderful.
Taylor just came back.
Did he come back on his official or on a new one?
He is a new one. You know.
Yeah.
But, he kind of hinted that he got the go ahead to do that. He didn't say it in so many words, but that was what I took from what he was saying when he was talking to Richard Hanania the other day, and he kind of implied that he got the go ahead to rejoin Twitter.
Well, Jared Taylor's a living legend, and it's great to have him on there. But I'd like to see everyone back. I'd like to see myself back. I'd like to see people like Race and Nature back. I'd like to see Warren Baylog, Mike Enoch, Laura Towler, Sam Melia, Dr. David Duke, Kevin McDonald. And I'm probably missing out people here who have been banned and should be back. I mean, there's so many names that deserve to be back on that platform and so many promises that have been broken. But over the last few weeks, it's been a pretty wild ride on Twitter, to say the very least, with Elon Musk firstly burning most of his goodwill before desperately trying to claw it back by heading for Keir Starmer's throat and attacking him and the entire Labour government over the grooming scandal. And the grooming scandal, I've got to say, there's still a steady trickle of news articles coming out about that, because the prosecutions keep coming because it's so widespread and it's still going on to this day. But it kind of died down a little bit in terms of the amount of publicity it was getting. But Elon Musk has brought it right back. And it's amazing to see the whole Labour government having to answer to this sort of tech billionaire who's essentially tweeting to please the dissident right. I mean, what do you think of all this?
I agree completely with your analysis. It's interesting. It is surreal. Like, I know you and me as well have been talking about the grooming gangs for years and years. I'm sure you were talking about it before I was, but I made like a 2-hour documentary about it about 4 years ago, where it was like a lot of it was based off the work of Peter McLaughlin, I think it is, that he wrote Easy Meat. And so that was like a big part of the doc, but I added a bunch of other stuff. And it's surreal to see all of a sudden everybody's talking about it. I said this on my show. I have sort of mixed feelings about it because obviously it's good to have more attention brought to this issue. But there's also something a little bit sort of depressing knowing that even if everybody on Twitter screams from the top of their lungs, we're not really going to get justice. You know what I mean? None of these police chiefs, none of these politicians involved in the cover-up are going to pay anything near the price that they should pay for this horrendous crime. So it's a little bit weird where it's like, hey, the most powerful man, and everybody's talking about it and millions of views, but it doesn't necessarily amount to anything.
Well, this is what I think. And as I said, when I started the show, I do a show on once a month called the Nationalist A-Team. And we basically play PUBG. There was four of us, but one of us was jailed. Sam Melia was jailed. So we haven't filled his spot. And one of the guys, a guy called Natty, he's one of the best commentators on the dissident right. And he only appears on a couple of shows. He does Book Club with me, occasional PWRs. But he comes on Nationalist A-Team and every month. And his takes are always on fire. And he put this forward, so I'm not going to take credit for him. I'm not going to take credit myself for his point. I'll give him the full credit for this. Natty came out and said, if Elon Musk's the richest man on the planet, he's got billions and billions and billions, so many billions that he probably makes tens of millions a day in interest alone on his investments. So money is literally no object to him. Now, I do appreciate him bringing up the grooming gang issue. And I think that's something that we should all be thankful for. And look, I'm not going to sit here and spit in his face. Not that I'm in any position to do that. He's much bigger than me by, a factor that's unimaginable. But I thank him for bringing it up. But there is something there is a little wrinkle in this, isn't there? Here is the richest man on the planet bringing this up and complaining there isn't going to be a government inquiry into it. Now, if Elon Musk wanted to, he could set aside 10, 20 million, never notice it missing ever. It'd be like chump change to him. You know, it's like pocket change. And he could fund the best funded independent inquiry that's ever taken place in Britain. He could, with freedom of information requests, make submissions to collect every single court report on grooming cases, collate the evidence, collate the names, the ethnicities of the perpetrators. He could log the number of cases. He could reveal the police forces involved and the number of officers that turned a blind eye to it. He could interview victims. He could even send people to the communities where it took place to photograph the houses these people live in, because some of them were wealthy men. You know, he could do this, and he could put forward a wealth of evidence that would literally be published on X, and the government would be forced to respond because it couldn't ignore evidence on that scale. And Natty basically said, this is a guy who brings up big issues and people are clapping like seals when he gives a tweet a thumbs up or a share or says, you know, something to think about, you know, with a quote tweet. But really, if he was a leftist, like George Soros is nowhere near as rich as Elon Musk. But George Soros, I despise the man, but you've got to respect him for the fact he puts his money where his mouth is. And if there was something like this happening to ethnic minorities, someone like George Soros would pump 5-10 million into an independent inquiry, publish it, put pressure on the government. But and what I'm really saying is Musk for real? And is it enough just to give thumbs up emojis to tweets? Should he be doing more if he cares? Because I think he should.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, they're already accusing him of, like, you know, political interference and all these kind of things anyways in the UK. So he may as well, you know, in for a penny, in for a pound. You're right. He should do some kind of, like, you know, privately funded think tank inquiry or whatever. And, you know, I know you know this, but, like, apparently this whole grooming gang thing, a lot of people are just learning about it for the first time. And people say, oh, we need a government inquiry. They already did a government inquiry. And it was the biggest whitewash I've ever seen in my life. It was an absolute travesty. And it led to headlines in the Huffington Post that read, like, actually, most grooming gangs are white people. And it was so pathetic. It was so transparent what they did there. So, you know, you're asking these people that have already over and over and over again failed to police themselves, failed to hold themselves accountable. And you're saying, please hold yourselves accountable. Please do something.
Well, look, I'll say this, because maybe you don't know my full history, but in 2004, in the run-up to the 2004 Euro elections, myself and another member of the British National Party, who was the leader at the time, Nick Griffin, gave a number of speeches in West Yorkshire in relation to the grooming epidemic. We were the first ones to expose it, and we were promptly arrested after a BBC sting operation, and we spent 2 to 3 years in court, 2005, 6 and 7, in and out of courts, fighting it. We were eventually found not guilty on all of the charges, but they tried to silence us because we were the first ones to blow the whistle on grooming. And the grooming scandal, everyone talks about Rotherham today, but the initial town that got the spotlight on it for grooming was a town in West Yorkshire called Keighley. And for a short period of time, I relocated to Keighley. And I was living, not she wasn't my partner or anything, but she had a spare room and she was a BNP councillor. And I lived there and assisted her, you know, dealing with her council work. Her name was Angela Clark. And I was working round the clock in Keighley, exposing the grooming scandal and working with people on the ground who were victims. It was something that, you know, at the time I was quite famous for because I was on the TV for it all the time. Now, obviously now everyone talks about Rotherham and Telford and Tommy Robinson, but this has been going on for a lot longer than even I was involved. And it keeps coming back up, but there is never a definitive end to it. And there are never definitive answers to anything. Not the number of victims, not the number of perpetrators, not the number of people who have been involved in the cover-up. And every single attempt to push for a proper inquiry has been met with a whitewash because there are so many people in positions of power all over the country, in social services, in local councils, in the police force, who were all involved in this in some way or another. That if the whole thing came out, it would be like flicking, you know, a house of cards. The whole thing would come down and the establishment would be in such turmoil, it might collapse. And that would be the kind of thing that could well lead to something like Nigel Farage and the Reform Party sweeping to power overnight.
Yeah, the thing you said about how we don't know the number of victims, that's something I know all too well. I actually did a debate with the leftist about grooming gangs again about 4.5 years ago, something like that. And this was kind of the whole debate for him was like, how many victims do you think there were? And I would say, well, we don't know the exact number, but we know it's at the bare minimum thousands.
The bare minimum, it's around 100,000. The highest estimate was from a Labour MP called Sarah Champion. And she estimated that there was around 1 million victims.
Right. And of course that came up and he's just like, oh, that's, she's just making where's the data? Where's the peer reviewed study? You know how it is. And I'm like, look, man, I can't give you the exact number, but surely thousands of rapes is enough. Surely that's enough to be concerned about. Like, what are we even doing here? You know?
Do you know what? I've done these debates with leftists and there's nothing more irritating than when you make sort of a reasonable point only to be met with where's the peer reviewed study. So you say, obviously I think, grown men adopting little boys, raping them, then pimping them out, you know, from their million-dollar mansions whilst being pushed down our throats as the perfect parents is a bad thing. And then but where's the peer reviewed study that backs that up? I need to see facts and data that these things hurt the children. And you're like, oh man. And that's one of the amazing things about being banned on YouTube. You know, people like myself got banned on YouTube for literally saying, you know, paedophilia is wrong and it is being tied in with the LGBT movement. But then there's all these left-wing YouTubers on YouTube making, you know, money from monetized videos. And their main thrusts of a lot of their arguments are that there should be a deregulation of sex with children. They're calling for legalized paedophilia.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I don't. Yeah, it's awful.
I mean, you're talking sort of Vouch tier and Destiny tier people here, but they literally make, you know, probably a six-figure living off pushing that kind of stuff on YouTube, and it goes on. Yet you speak out about it like I do. And you're off YouTube because it might offend the advertisers. The advertisers don't seem to be offended about having their products alongside some sort of left-wing pedo activist. It's absolutely mad. And the way the grooming scandal is being talked of by the establishment, not by normal people, because most normal people in the UK are appalled by it, but left-wing activists are trying to sort of rebrand it as some kind of moral panic or some kind of mass hysteria.
They did that on Wikipedia. Yeah.
Yeah. They rebranded it, the grooming, and
they used that whitewashed government report as a justification. They say, oh, the government looked into it. I picked that report apart bit, but it's just like transparent. What they used data from 2011, which was before by their own admission before the police were arresting people for these crimes. It makes no sense, though. You would have to intentionally do that to try to mislead the public, right? So people should be punished for that. People should be held accountable. I want to ask you this about the grooming gangs too, because something that's always struck me as strange, and maybe I just don't understand UK geography enough, and I'm just missing something, but you have all these places, Rotherham, Keighley, like you said, a bunch of other ones. I forget some of them, but Manchester. And then you have London, which is like the Muslim capital of the UK, and you don't have grooming gang scandals in London. And that's always struck me as odd.
Well, let me explain. Now, most of the grooming gangs are Pakistani Muslims, okay? And I say that because they're specifically Pakistani Muslims. That's who are the main perpetrators of the grooming scandal. Now, these people came to Britain between the late 1940s and early 1960s, and they came here en masse to work in factories in the mills. So all over northern England, there are small towns called mill towns, towns like Blackburn, Oldham and Burnley, where the textile industry was located. Now, the people who brought them here were basically big business capitalists who owned the means of production, and they were bringing in these Pakistani Muslims because they wanted to pay lower wages, they wanted them to work longer hours, and they wanted to ensure, you know, less or fewer workers' rights. So these people were brought in to replace the white working class in these mills. And they came here in huge numbers, mainly men. And over time, they sent for their families and brought their families. And they took over these towns. So you have, like, as I said, Rotherham, Keighley. You have places like Bradford. That's a city. And these areas were completely sort of colonized by these people, to the point where certain parts of certain towns, like Savilltown in Dewsbury, there isn't a single white person living there. Well, there might be one, but you know what I mean? You'd be pushed to find one because they've completely taken them over. Now, I don't know what the racial composition or the ethnic composition of the Muslim population in London is, but my sort of initial reaction to what you've said is they might be Bangladeshi Muslims, or they might be from a different part of the world. And it seems to be something that is endemic amongst specifically this Pakistani Muslim population. And I've read a few reports saying a lot of these men come from a part of the Punjab, and there's something there in their culture where they do treat women like this who aren't part of their own group. And it becomes quite a complex thing, because this mindset isn't just the mindset of the men, it's also the mindset of the women and the other Muslims in their community. So I've seen interviews with women from these Muslim communities, and they'll be quite honest and say, well, I've got no problem with my husband doing this because these aren't Muslims. It's not classed as adultery. You know, as far as I'm concerned, these girls are sort of dirty. They're subhuman. They're not like us. So what he does to them, it's no different to what he might do to a pet or, you know, something he owns. And then you see that it's a community-wide problem. And I've raised this point many times before, and this is one of the most uncomfortable points. But the size and scale of this criminality could only take place with community support. So you couldn't have this many people operating without a community supporting them and sheltering them. So, you know, their wives know, the men's wives know what they're doing. Their families know what they're doing. You know, this is an open secret within these communities. And that makes it even worse, because fundamentally, it isn't just the actions of a few rogue males. It's a widespread problem that many males are engaged in who receive the support and the tacit sort of, like, you know, agreeance of people within their community who cover for them.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I remember a story from a while back where there was a Muslim woman who was working in the police force, and she went in and, like, erased some evidence. you know, and so you have stuff like that happening. You're right. It's like it's a whole community. They're all in on it, basically. It's the only way it can happen. And I wonder if it is happening to some degree in London, but it's just in a more urban area. It's even harder to kind of notice those patterns, maybe. And also, you know how people are, and they're kind of more atomized and individualized and mind their own business in big cities than they do in smaller communities. So maybe that's part of it too.
I mean, it may happen. The other thing in London that might muddy the waters is the racial mix in London. So London is, you know, to use their phraseology, an extremely diverse city. So diverse that white Britons make up only around 36% of the city now. So grooming gangs may well not target exclusively white girls. They may target, you know, mixed race girls, girls from the Afro-Caribbean community, because one of the largest Afro-Caribbean communities is in London. And there might be different responses from those communities than the grooming gangs received from the white community, because there were some dads who did try to fight back. They were arrested for doing so and silenced, which is another part of the scandal. But it would be much more difficult for the police to silence, you know, angry black dads or angry Indian dads, because there's a racial component to that and they're not treated with the same contempt that Indigenous Britons are.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
I mean, look, I know what can you say? I mean, yeah. when you're looking at this, it's truly an epidemic, but where it hits hardest is in places where there is a clear community divide between the Indigenous people and the Pakistani Muslim community. So that is where you have these cities, like cities and towns like Bradford, Rotherham, Telford, you know, Keighley. London, as I said, seems, I'm sure it does happen in London, but London is a much more complex issue. And I also think the thing with London, I do believe if those groups sort of grooming gangs, say, did target certain, like, you know, Afro-Caribbean communities, they might get more pushback as well. It's a complex thing. But saying everything I've just said, if I woke up tomorrow and it was all over the front page of the papers that a massive grooming scandal, you know, had just been uncovered in London, I wouldn't be shocked. I wouldn't be shocked. It's just we haven't. It tends to be confined to the towns with the racial makeup that, you know, I've talked about. And that's where the BNP did really well. So the BNP did really well in Bradford. It did really well in Keighley. It did well in Blackburn, Oldham and Burnley, Rotherham. You know, we got good votes there, because we were the only party talking about this. And I know Tommy Robinson gets the credit now. And I'm not saying Tommy Robinson did nothing. I'm not rubbishing Tommy Robinson. Tommy Robinson is obviously a guy that has very, very, you know, much dedicated his life to talking about this. And for all my differences with him on Zionism and Israel, I do obviously agree with him about the grooming issue. And I thank him for raising those points. But the fact is, it was the BNP that put this on the map. We were the ones campaigning first in Keighley, Bradford, Rotherham, Oldham, Burnley, Blackburn. And we were the ones that lifted the lid on it. And we paid. You know, I sort of lost 3 years of my life to the stress of court appearances because of this. You know, and I was standing to be jailed for 7 years for talking about it. And right now, as we speak, I am absolutely sure that there are people within the government and people within the police and the establishment who want to do the same to me again for talking about the things that we're talking about tonight.
Yeah, you're right. Because I did that documentary, I'm pretty familiar with the timeline. And you said like 2004, you were that was kind of like the earliest that almost anyone was making a public outcry about this. So yeah, it's great that you did that. You know, it's sucks that that the hammer came down on you harder because of that, but you did the right thing, obviously.
Well, the life of someone who swims against the current and opposes the establishment is never a life of ease and happiness, but a life of constant strife and headaches. But it's the life I chose, so tough for me, I suppose. But
yeah. Well, one other thing I want to throw in about the grooming gangs here is that you know, and this ties into what you're saying about how they came here. They came as legal immigrants. And so there is a like an irony with this Elon Musk situation where he's like, well, we got to bring in all these H-1Bs. We got to bring in all these high-skilled workers and immigrants. And everybody's like, no, we don't want that. And then to sort of like change the topic, he jumps on grooming gangs. And it's like, hey, Elon, you know, those people came here legally, right? Like, you know, this whole idea that, oh, I don't hate immigration. I just hate illegal immigration. Well, it turns out legal immigration has its own set of issues as well.
Well, this is the thing about Elon. I did a post about this on my Telegram and Gab the other day. And I said, it's all well and good for Elon Musk to be going mad over grooming gangs. And I'm pleased that he is. But right. The fact is, the root cause of the grooming scandal is, in fact, mass immigration. And it's mass immigration from people that came here legally to replace the white working class. And Elon Musk is a man who has fired entire factories full of white American Tesla workers to replace them with migrants. He's a man that's shilling hard for H-1B visas for people from the Indian subcontinent. Now, I'm not saying Elon Musk is responsible for the grooming scandal. That's not what I'm saying. That would be libelous and it would be ridiculous. But it's men like Elon Musk who are responsible for the grooming scandal. It's the super rich owners of the means of production who sacked white working people and replaced them with legal migrants in order to increase their profits. They did that, and the knock-on effect was grooming. And, you know, Musk is pursuing the same policies that led to the nightmares that he claims to rage about. And at that point, you've got to ask why. And the reason you've got to ask why is because this guy's not an idiot. Now, if I was dealing with some 95 IQ, you know, special brew drinking, you know it all off the local estate, I could understand them not making the link between immigration and grooming. I could understand them not, you know, putting two and two together. But Elon Musk is a high IQ, well-informed man with teams of advisors who could get his fingers on all kinds of data and put this all together. And he's spending all day scrolling through Twitter feeds, reading about these things. So he'll know about me and Nick Griffin. He'll know about the extent of the grooming scandal. Right. And he'll know the people who carried it out. But the fact is, despite him claiming to be so outraged, he is still going to pursue the same policies that brought about the nightmare he claims to rage against.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. It's these rich industrial billionaires and businessmen, and also the politicians that enable them by allowing that to happen.
And the thing is, and I've said this on a video. I did a video about Elon Musk and his Indian migration. It's on my Odyssey. It's on my Rumble. I know my weekly videos don't get the views they used to get, but it's an important point to restate, and I made it here. The first waves of mass immigration into Britain and America and all over the Western world were clearly low-paid migrant workers intended to replace the white working class. That was done with great effect, and white working class communities were broken up, destroyed, atomized, and they now lie in ruin. So you can go to these towns and cities that were once working class strongholds, and they're just a complete wreck now. That's just how life is all over the Western world. But this drive to bring in Indians with the H-1B visas, this is part of a wider drive taking place all over the Western world to bring people here from India to do middle management jobs that used to be done by the white middle class. And to me, this is a clear process of, well, now we've done away with the white working class, let's do the same to the white middle class. But we're not going to do that with Pakistanis and sub-Saharan Africans. We're going to do it with Indians because we think they'll make a better artificial middle class for white countries.
Yeah, that's very astute. You're right. Yeah, there's, you know, the average IQ of India is 75, which is shockingly low, but there's so many of them. So I don't know if I'm allowed to say that. There's so many of them that you can find enough semi-competent ones to do the job, and they'll do it way cheaper, right? So that's exactly what's happening.
But the amazing thing with India, I don't know if you know this, I did another video on this, and the video was called something like Indian, Tommy Robinson, you know, multiculturalism and Indian migration, because he's a big fan of Indian migration, just like Elon. But India is actually, or was recently ranked, the most unsafe country in the world for women. It's got the highest rates of child marriage, one of the highest rates of sex slavery, the highest rate of rape and child rape. It's a shocking country when it comes to things like acid attacks and, you know, these dowry suicides. And it's shocking. Do we really want to say, look, we've just been through this grooming scandal, but now let's import all of these Indians that come from a part of the world where there's a rape epidemic?
Yeah, I mean, it's just so shocking that people are still playing dumb about this. You know, there's been a couple, I know you're not on Twitter, so you're maybe not tuned in as much as I am, because I'm a Twitter junkie, but there's been a couple of these like Indian advocates through this whole spiel. And there's this one guy his name's like Siddharth or something like that. And he's like, I'm a high skilled immigrant. And he's like, he's advocating for this in these spaces and that, and people go and search his tweets. And he's like talking about how Indians are superior to white people. White people deserve to suffer, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like all that kind of dirty laundry. And then there's this other guy, I forget his name, another Indian guy doing the same thing. And then it came out that he was like the COO of Gab, Andrew Torba's Gab, when they first launched. And he got fired because he was sending DMs to women on Gab and trying to get, you know, Bob and Vagin photos from them. And he was doing it so much, they had to get rid of him.
The thing is, memes come about because of pattern recognition. And then when somebody raises a meme and they say, look, we've created this funny picture that sort of pokes fun at this thing that you all know happens, then everyone laughs and the meme becomes sort of gold. And the meme about Indians is always about them sending creepy messages to girls on Instagram and Facebook and asking for nude pictures. And, you know, these things, as much as the establishment wants to make out that we make these things up and sort of meme them into reality, that's not the case. A meme is funny because it reflects something that happens and characterizes it in an amusing or whimsical fashion. And these memes, they're a window into the truth. And when all these Indians get here, and most of them will be single males who come over, just like the Pakistani Muslims, of single males who came over first, and then some of them sent for their families. And to their, you know, they do actually have families. But these single Indian men, I mean, what are they going to make life like for, you know, white women in Western countries?
Well, we already know the answer to that because we've seen it happen in Canada already. Canada has been browned. They've been on a speed run of this. They do it through student visas. And there was a video that was going viral just the other day for New Year's Eve in Granville, which is like kind of the entertainment district in Vancouver. And it's all brown men. And there's like almost no women. And you ask yourself, whoa, that's a little weird. Why aren't the women out celebrating New Year's Eve too? And it's because they can't do it without getting harassed in a place like that.
Well, it's really funny you say that, because the same thing is true in the UK. The visa system has become absolutely broken because of university admissions. But this may shock you. Like, when I first read this, I was just like, so you hear about chain migration, don't you? And you hear about, you know, one visa isn't necessarily for one person. Now, obviously, I'm not saying this is right, and it annoys me because you have one visa for one Indian tech worker, then he brings his wife and three children, so one visa equals five people. But when you talk about a student visa, you expect it to literally be what you think. One visa, one student. But in the UK, there's been cases where you've had like one Indian guy coming over and he's brought his brother, his sister, his grandma, his granddad. And you're thinking, how's this even happening? Like, this is an absolute conspiracy against white people and a complete abuse of the visa system, to the point where, you know, normal people, if you stop the normal person on the street and said, did you know that the visa system is abused in the way that, you know, Indians come here to university and they can bring their families or members of their families to come with them to assist them as they stay? People wouldn't believe you. They'd think it was some kind of like, you know, far right conspiracy theory.
Yeah, that is crazy. And, you know, I've known some international students in my day, and through just my personal experiences with interacting, and I had a couple as roommates, so I got to know them pretty well. And I developed a theory that international students are like going to be lower quality people on average, because I think it's the parents can afford to like send them away, and they want to get rid of them and like just get away from me, you're causing problems. And so they send them to other countries because they can afford to do that, and then you get to know these people and they're just like really like not quality people.
Well, you see, that's the thing as well. Once you see, they have all these cunning ways, and we'll get onto the Bruv Party in a minute, but they have all these cunning ways of sort of twisting people's arms at their back. So they say, oh, well, look, they're just student visas. They're only coming here in order to study. Now, to the normal person, what does that mean? Well, it means one person gets one visa, they come to the UK, they study, and they go home. What does it mean in reality? Well, it means one person comes on one visa, brings their family, and then when they qualify, they get a golden ticket to stay and work here. And then the Conservatives will say, well, it would be absolutely ridiculous to spend all that money training them and then let the skills leave the country. We'd be mad to do that. And you're like, oh, my God. And then all these people who are sort of like your midwit kind of libertarian, you know, conservative types of all sort of like, that makes perfect sense. Why would we let this human capital leave? And it's like, oh, my God.
Yeah, it really is like we're getting bent over from every direction, because a lot of the incentive to bring those students in is, you already touched on this, is to make money for the schools. A lot of that comes from taxpayers. Well, I don't know if international students get student loans. They probably don't. I don't actually know about that. But either way, they
Google this. How much British taxpayer assistance do foreign students get? Is this going to cause me to have like an aneurysm on stream of pure rage?
I mean, either way, they're doing it to make money for the schools. And I think in Canada, and I think there's the economy is an illusion that's being propped up by just a lot of sort of, you know, weird accounting. And that's like one example of it, where they bring in all these students who have money, they pour their money into the university system, and then they can pretend like the economy is good, but the economy is not actually producing anything, especially not anything of value.
Have you just done something to your mic? Because your mic's changed.
No. What happened? Am I quiet?
No, you come back to normal now.
Okay.
Sorry. Maybe a loose connection. So I'm looking here. Funding for international students. Following Brexit, funding for international students now covers those from the EU hoping to live and study in the UK as well as other countries worldwide. Therefore, it is essential for anyone living outside the UK to be aware of funding options and support available. It is important to note that this doesn't necessarily apply to existing EU students after Brexit. A government scheme already in place ensures these individuals can stay within the funding bracket they're currently in. Unfortunately, there is no there is currently no cap on tuition fees for international students like there is for UK students. The amounts can vary significantly depending on the university and course you choose to study. For this reason, studying in the UK when you're not a resident can end up being rather costly. While UK students only pay up to £9,250 per year, the cost of a degree for an international student can range from £10,000 up to £38,000 or even more for medical degrees. Why study in the UK? Funding options. These include family, private companies, student loans, scholarships, grants and bursaries, student exchange, bank loans. So there's a variety. Basically, they're falling over to provide funding options for people to come to the UK. And whereas and some of it's also a tax scam. So what you will have is, you know, people coming here from overseas and funneling money through their children into British bank accounts to hide it. That does happen, especially with, you know, certain rich pupils from certain parts of the world.
Yeah, it's the same in Canada, too. It's, and that is another point. You're right that they charge more. They charge less. So the universities love to have those students come in because they're like cash cows. And you see what's happened in Canada, which is because Canada doesn't have a very big population. I forget exactly, but I think it's around 40 million or less than that. It's not that many people compared to somewhere like America. And so the demographic change has, like, just in terms of the percentages, has hit a lot harder. And what you see, you can go on like Reddit now and read posts from Canadians who are basically racist at this point. And that's not an easy thing to do. It's not easy to turn the average Canadian racist. I know there's always some exceptions, but they're posting about how, like, I don't like what's happening. I don't like how our country is changing and stuff like that.
The thing is, nobody wants to admit that they have those feelings in the West for obvious reasons. Yet the governments of the West are literally turning people sort of, in inverted commas, racist. Now, you know, the BBC and the government will have you think that it's actually me and my organization that flies around the country, you know, brainwashing people and making them hate everyone. But organizations like Patriotic Alternative and, you know, streamers like ourselves, we gain prominence because of the government's decision making and people's general dissatisfaction with the decisions the government makes. And the fact that it doesn't matter how loud people cry about the problems, the government still pursues the same issues. You know, I think the same's happening here in the UK. People are getting more and more sick of it. But I think that's mirrored across every Western country.
Yeah. I think so, and that's kind of a white pill in a way, that the public opinion is headed in the right direction. I am optimistic about the future. I think we still have like one or more decades of fighting ahead of us, but I am cautiously optimistic that things are headed in the right direction despite all the problems and challenges.
I'm not so optimistic. I've got to say this. We're in this sort of death struggle at the moment where, on one hand, you know, white people do seem to be waking up quicker than ever. But on the other hand, we're being replaced quicker than ever. And it's like that race, which comes first? Do we wake up and turn it around, or do we become a minority? And my fear, especially when you look at the demography of the UK, is that people are going to wake up and it'll either be 2 or 3 years before they become a minority and things have gone too far, so they won't be able to turn it around. Or it will literally be, you know, days after they become a minority. They'll wake up one morning and all the papers will say, oh, official government statistics now say white Britons are a minority, and people will be up in arms, but it'd be too late. And the reason I say this, and I've repeated this statistic many, many times, and I'll keep repeating it. I did a video on it late last year. You know, you go into British schools, you know, children between the ages of 5 and 16, and the demographics state that 61.3% of the population in British schools is white British. So by 2035, the government itself predicts by its own statistics that white Britons will be a minority in British schools. So in 10 years, that's it. And those people will then grow up, those children will then grow up into adults, and that wave will wave through society, will move through society. And the only places in society where whites are overrepresented are in the older age bracket. And that's, I think we're in a bad place. I think we're in a bad place. And you look at the schools, they are the most non-white parts of society.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right about that. When I say I'm optimistic, I'm thinking I'd like to say more big picture or long term, but so you're right. The UK may never look like it did in the 50s ever again. Probably won't. Canada will never be like a majority Anglo country or just like a white country. But I think that I have faith in white people to be able to overcome that and build something new. It might not look the same as what we used to have, but you see this happening already in some places, like in South Africa, you have this Orania community. I'm sure you've heard about them. And I think as people wake up and start to say, you know what, I'm white and it's okay for me to say that I prefer being around white people. It's okay for me to say like a white people should have a home where they're the super majority and other people are seen as guests and visitors in our home. And as more and more people just get over that little hump of being able to say that, I do think we're going to be able to build something great in the future.
You know what? I fundamentally agree. You see, this is where I'm at. I believe that we will overcome these problems, but I believe we'll overcome things by thinking outside the box and by creating communities and doing things like they've done in South Africa with Orania. I believe that white people will overcome. I believe we will triumph, but I don't think it's going to be via, you know, ballot box politics in the here and now. I think you're going to see things in America like the project, I think it's called Azakia, where they're basically buying all the land in the Ozarks and they're going to populate that, create their own community, and they're going to be a self-governing, you know, pro-white community like they've got in Orania. And I think there's lots of things that will happen, but I don't think they're going to happen as you would traditionally expect. This isn't going to be a repeat of sort of the 1930s where sort of fascist parties come to power and you're going to see this incredible, turnaround in society. Right. I think it's going to come from a different position. I think it's going to almost be sort of late stage Roman Empire. Everything crumbles, you know, late stage capitalism will infect the people and those that break free from that will start again and create something wonderful and new. That's really how I see it. I see it more as the phoenix rising from the flames. That's my sort of, you know, take on it.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I know we have an emotional attachment to our nations, as we should, but that's just sort of the cycle of history. Is sometimes like these things don't last forever, but as long as our people survive, that's really what matters, right?
Well, that's what I think. And I've been saying this to people. England is sacred to our people because our people built England. But if the English people were sort of moved to a Scottish island, they wouldn't all become Scottish. They'd create a mini version of England on that Scottish island. So it's not really the soil. I mean, we love the soil because it's our home. But it's the blood that is important. It's who we are that is important. It's what runs in our veins. You know, that's why when you bring, say, Polish people to the UK, they create a little Polish community and they might not be on, you know, Polish soil, but they create a little Poland with the Polish bakers, the Polish delicatessen, with, you know, places they can go, their own community centers, places where they celebrate their culture. And as long as we exist, we can always come back. And that's where I think the hope comes from. But come on, man, we've got to talk about the Bruv Party. I mean, this has blown my mind. Andrew Tate's Bruv Party. What do you think, mate? Is Andrew Tate going to sweep to power with the Bruv Party?
I mean, I have mixed feelings about it. I know Andrew. I've done a couple streams with him, and that, and like I get along with him on a personal basis. Obviously,
I would love to speak to him. I would love. I can tell you this now. If I streamed with that guy, I would love to. I mean, look, not disrespectfully, but I would love to actually hold him accountable for some of the things he said, but drill down and find out what he actually thinks. So what do you think he actually thinks?
Well, the last time I streamed with him was a little over 4 years ago. And so it was kind of before he completely blew up. Like he wasn't as famous as he was when I talked. And what we talked to him on that stream about was because I knew he was doing the cam girls, and we kind of like argued with him and were like, hey, you know, the morality of this, you shouldn't be doing. I literally said to him too, I said, you're going to catch a rape charge if you keep doing this. I was like, it's like inevitable. It's like a statistical inevitability. If you keep messing with more and more and more women, you will eventually catch a rape charge regardless of what you do. So that was kind of, that aged well, suffice it to say. But so I don't agree, obviously, with, you know, I have my moral qualms. He doesn't do that anymore, but I think he still like runs casinos and does some stuff that I consider to be kind of unsavory and shady in that. But when I say I like him, I just mean like on a personal level, like I think he's kind of funny and he has some interesting things to say. As far as like, you know, becoming the PM of the UK, I have mixed feelings about this because it's like, you know, he's mixed race, he's Muslim, he's really not the ideal candidate. When I say, who do I want to be the leader of, and I mentioned this to you before the stream, but I kind of consider the UK to be my homeland because that's where my people are from. That's what my heritage is. My DNA is largely Anglo, so I have a special affinity for it. And I do, like, when I look at somebody like Nigel Farage, I do think, like, this is kind of what a British statesman should look like, what he should sound like. You know, I just like, I like the vibe, I guess you could say, more than this sort of braggadocious, like, machismo kind of, like, abrasive style that Andrew Tate has. But having said that, I don't know if, like, Farage has what it takes. I don't know if Andrew Tate has what it takes either, but it's kind of hard for me to imagine that he would be worse, at least when it comes to the issues that are most important to me, like immigration. It's hard for me to imagine, just given the rhetoric that he's using, that he would be a worse leader than just about anybody else who's like a viable option. I would love to see somebody like you, you know, as the PM of the UK, but I'm not going to hold my breath for that.
Don't hold your breath on that one, mate. Do not hold your breath. But look, I've pulled up, this is from the Indy 100, and these are his seven most extreme policies. Now, let's just review these quickly, because I looked at these and I did really, really like them, actually. And look, I'm not an Andrew Tate fan. I've said that in the past, but
he had something about like televising the solitary confinement of he wants to turn the criminal justice system into a reality TV show. I thought that was really funny.
Well, this is good. Punishing the BBC, like that. Punishing the BBC. Zero tolerance for knife crime. I mean, illegal immigration to fall to zero, enforced by the Royal Navy. I mean, these are, they're very memeable, but I do agree with them. This is brilliant. Banning LGBTQ plus propaganda from schools. You know, this is what you want to hear. English signage, flags and traditional architecture in every British street. Well, really what he's saying here is we don't want minarets of mosques. We want everything to be, you know, printed in English. This is our land. You know, cutting foreign aid and aid spending to zero. No more foreign aid. No more foreign wars. Weekly referendums. Prioritizing NHS healthcare for Britain's first. So basically saying, look, the indigenous people should be at the front of the queue. Accountability yeah. from those in government. This makes me laugh because they're saying these are extreme pledges. Well, I don't think it's particularly extreme to suggest.
It's actually like common sense and good policy. I think, though, like you said, it's kind of a meme. Like I like all these ideas, too. I don't know what kind of electability prospects he actually has, but let's just say for the sake of argument that he could get elected. And I understand the UK system is not like the America where you just run for president, right? You have to have a party and you have to take the majority of the seats in order. That's how it works, right?
Yeah.
Correct me.
Yeah.
So it's not like he can just say, I'm running for PM and then everybody votes for him. He has to, it's a lot of work. You got to get a whole party. You got to win a lot of seats. But even if he does that, then he also has to get all of these things through parliament. So it's an uphill
battle. The thing is, with the British system, I actually did a video. It wasn't a video. It was a live stream. It's kind of like a lecture with questions and answers afterwards. It's called something like, everyone should watch my videos. This one was called, is the electoral route a dead end? And I explained in great detail how difficult it was to overcome the British electoral. Like, the British electoral system was fashioned in such a way that it would naturally produce this sort of two-party, you know, oligarchy that would, you know, bounce people between the two parties as the only viable options and make it almost impossible for a third party to gain the membership, the support and the funding in order to break that. And the only party that has been able to do that post-Second World War is actually the Reform Party. And I say that because the Reform Party has now surpassed 175,000 members, meaning it's bigger than the Conservative Party, and it's knocking on the numbers of the Labour Party, which means, look, Farage, whether you like him or hate him, and I have my differences with him, he is literally the only man that can break the two-party system. And he is the only man that can actually realign British politics and potentially open the door to a more radical alternative.
Yeah, I mean, you would know better than me. I'll take it at face value. You're probably right. But again, the fact that the Reform Party, even though, you know, like Farage, he says some things that are very like kind of civ natty, however you want to put it, a little bit disappointing, but you also understand he's got that it is what it is. Like, that's the world we live in. You can't be right. If Andrew Tate wanting to lock up people for stabbing is an extreme policy, then you kind of understand where he's coming from when he takes a more moderate approach. But it is just still the fact that the Reform Party is gaining steam is, again, something to be optimistic about. You see the same thing in Germany with the AfD, which Musk has also been pushing. I heard he's doing like a space soon with one of the AfD politicians. And so I think that's promising, right? When the AfD got started, I don't think anybody expected them, just like the Reform Party, to go anywhere, but they are.
They are. I mean, sort of, again, the AfD would more be a vehicle to move things further to the right than actually be the vehicle I think would deliver on the things we want. Same with Reform. But one thing I'll say about Tate and the Brov Party, and then we'll start doing these super chats. We can talk for a bit longer. Financial support's been slightly lower than it was sort of previous week, so we don't actually have as many super chats. So if you want a super chat and ask a question, please do. There's still another hour of the show. Now, the issue with the Brov Party, and I'm not a fan of Andrew Tate, but I do like what he's doing here. And I like what he's doing here is because he's literally adopting the same manifesto that the British, more or less word for word, that the British National Party had at the height of its electoral power in 2008 and 2009. And that says something, because for him, a social media influencer of sort of mixed race origin, to be coming out with these talking points like white Britons to the front of the queue, you know, I'm sure he said British jobs for British workers in there, you know, stop, you know, zero immigration. Basically, you know, if you're stuck out in the sea, we've got no. I mean, that's one of his points. He said, if you're stuck out in the sea, we've got no obligation to take you. You know, if your boat sinks, you know, tough, you shouldn't have done it. Now, they were the points the BNP were making. So really, for someone like Tate to be making this, exactly the same policy points that Britain's most popular and successful ethno-nationalist party ever made, well, that can't be a bad thing. You know, and it's interesting he's choosing to do this. Now, I don't think he's going to be prime minister. I don't think he's going to be someone that changes the political scene. But you know why I think Tate's important? And this might shock you. And it's going to shock my audience and it's going to annoy some people. But I'll tell you this. He reaches some people that I don't reach. He reaches sort of a more urban bracket of youth,
right.
Probably people that aren't as intellectual. A lot of people that watch this show are people that like reading long articles, love watching long form videos. He reaches the kind of people that their attention span's much shorter. They speak differently. They won't want to come to a PA conference and listen to, you know, 6 30-minute speeches. That's not their thing. You know, right. They wouldn't want to come and camp with us and have hot dogs and go on a hike. They're people that they live in the towns, they live in the cities, they speak differently, they act differently. He's reaching them, and he's reaching them with the same policies that really I'm pushing. And for that, I take my hat off to him, because I don't like him on everything, but I like him for doing what he's doing with this bruv party thing, because it's funny, it's on the nose, and it normalizes our talking points.
Yeah, you're right. And I mean, say what you want about Andrew Tate, but he's not a dumb guy. Like, he's not as dumb as he sounds sometimes. Let me put it that way. When you listen to him talk, I know it's easy to be like, I'll listen to this like low IQ dude, but he's actually like, he kind of knows what he's doing. He knows how to get attention. He knows how to meme things. I mean, this guy's got 10 million followers on Twitter, right? Like, he's popular. And he knows how to play to a crowd. So I think you're right. I think overall it has to be a good thing that will get attention onto these nationalist talking points.
Do you know what I see Andrew Tate as? Andrew Tate, to me, he has got... So there's several high IQ things you can have. You know, you can be somebody who's high IQ and you can be a great writer. You can be somebody who's high IQ and, you know, you can play something like PUBG. And you see these young players who know all the moves. They've got great reaction speeds and they outthink all the other players. You know, there are people that can do the highest level of Sudokus. And there are lots of different expressions of high IQ. But I would say Andrew Tate is almost like a high IQ salesman. Now, I don't know whether he can think on the fly. But he is someone who has clearly spent hundreds of hours in front of the mirror repeating his points in a very charismatic manner and learning how to put over these points. So when you see him in interviews, he kind of knows what people are going to ask. And when he knows what someone's going to ask, he has the response, he fires it forward in a charismatic way, almost like a salesman who's sold the same toaster door to door for 10 years. And when he meets that housewife, he knows she's going to ask two or three of, you know, 12 regular questions. And he's got the perfect answer to every one. And he does that with a great degree of charisma. And young lads love him. I remember, you know, well, I know people in the nationalist movement, young lads who, and I'm not his biggest fan, but they love him. They think he's, Tate, he's funny, he's whimsical, he's got the memes, he's got the ladies, he's got the cash, he's got the bling. And I don't have any of those things. I've got a lady, but I've only got the one of her. You know, I mean, I think she'd be the first one to complain. If I was like, come on, love, I'm getting the ladies in tonight. You know, so I'm not. She better not be listening, or she'd be outside the door with a meat cleaver. But, you know, he's got those things that young people cover, whereas I'm not really sure. I'm just seeing if she's heard that, I'll be getting an angry text. I'm actually seeing if that's her. Somebody has just texted me. No, it's not her. It's just a spam text. You know, he's got that, and that appeals to young people, because I'm not the bling guy. You know, I'm not the guy who's surrounded by dozens of 20-year-old beauties. And with that kind of persona, that does attract men. Somebody said, who wants more than one woman? Who wants more than one? That's a complex question.
Sounds good when you're young, I think.
Look, I could cope with more than one woman if every woman did a distinct and different job.
Mm.
So, like, if one woman was just in the house to, like, bake bread, and one woman was just in the house to sort of skip around the bedroom looking cute, and one woman was in the house because she was brilliant at, like, polishing, like, the taps and the shower. But if all the women were trying to be everything to you at the same time, and you had to be everything to them, that would be like the definition of hell. Like seven or eight women all trying to be your wife at the same time, all henpecking you, all asking, when are you doing the, you know, one's like, when are you trimming the hedges? And one goes, when are you going to the supermarket? Are you going to wash my car? When are you putting petrol in the car? Because we've got to take our daughter. You'd be like, no, stop. I couldn't do it. I've never understood how these men have seven wives and they're not sort of, you know, it just doesn't shorten their lifespan by about 50%.
Yeah, I don't really get it either. I think the women must be kind of meeker on average than my wife, to put it that way. I couldn't handle seven of her.
Oh God. I definitely think at times if my wife could have cloned herself, they would have ganged up, physically overpowered me, and I would be in a shallow grave in the garden by now. So, you know, I fear being, you know, in the same way that I am sort of, what can I say, skeptical of being racially outnumbered. I am skeptical of being outnumbered by wives because I fear it might affect my long-term survival prospects.
Real. That's so real.
This has really gone off the boat. Where's this stream going? What next, mate? What next? Where do we go? Do we do the super chats or are we just going crazy? Should we do some super chats?
Yeah, may as well.
We may as well. Okay. This is a guy, 1488. Thank you so much from It's Okay to Be a Nationalist. Thank you so much, my friend. He said, intro for LP.
Good guy.
Yeah. Yeah, he says, LP is a racist, sexist, homophobic, transphobic, anti-Semitic Anglo, and above replacement rate father. Also, high IQ, Mensa confirmed. Take that, leftists. I know, do you know, one of the ways you understand that you're high IQ is because you get all the jokes in Murdoch, Murdoch. You know that you can play that for people. And some people, that Murdoch, Murdoch is like the show that if you don't get the jokes, you know, you sort of like, yeah, you're definitely sub 100.
You also have to be a little bit terminally online, I think.
You see, I think you do, but I also think you have to just have a good grasp of things. And there are, you know, there are some clever jokes. So I always liked Arthur Donald, the sort of retarded MAGA fan. And I just found him funny. But I didn't realize that was a joke of Arthur Donald from Reddit. And there are some things that are like high-level memes that you might miss if you're not so invested online. But you still get the sort of underlying, you know, gist of the joke. And that's why they were geniuses. Like, you know, if I ever... Listen here, Murdoch creators. If I ever hit it big time, you know, if I ever buy some, you know, rubbishy little crypto and get like 10 million tokens and they go to like $10 a token and I've got 100 million in the bank, I am so employing the three of you to make Murdoch's forever just for like our personal amusement. You've got my promise on that, Murdoch creators. I will give you, if I make it big, you are going to be well looked after. That's what I do. You know, if I had loads of money, I think I would do crazy things like that. I would support like content creators, the little guy. I would love that.
Definitely. Yeah, well, I mean, it would be so worth it in their case.
We don't usually do these Odyssey token super chats because they annoy me. But I got this one off Black Pigeon Pilled, and I'm gonna do it. Look, I'm one of these guys. I'm the last guy in the world that still reads out dollar super chats. Everyone else is like, nah, there's a $10 minimum. But I'm good to my word. I read out any real money super chat. And this one is not a real money super chat, but it does deserve being read out because I want to just raise this. He says, what's your best memory of Jean-Marie Le Pen? And yeah, rest in peace, Jean-Marie Le Pen, a true warrior for the white race. France's best hope. France's probably greatest son post-Second World War. Sadly, he passed away. I think his passing was announced today or yesterday. And he was somebody that I met. I met him on two occasions. I was invited as a delegation to go to the Front National's annual festival in Paris. I went there with Nick Griffin and another group from the BNP. And also, I met him when he came to Britain to speak at a BNP event. He was a thoroughly engaging man and had an amazing presence. And I've got to say, when he reached the runoffs of the French presidential election, that was a seismic moment. And I know a lot of these things are lost to history, you know, they become chip paper, but I don't think we should ever forget that Le Pen got that far and was the real deal. He was the man that hosted David Duke's 40th birthday party in Paris. This man, you know, he was friends with proper nationalists, but he went to the top. So rest in peace, Jean-Marie Le Pen. I don't know if you've got anything to say about him, if you knew anything about him.
I didn't know that much about him, but I do vaguely remember the runoff thing you mentioned. Rest in peace.
Thank you. Pure Nomad gave 1488. Thanks so much. Said, good work on the Bramley protest, all at PA. Yes, Patriotic Alternative had its first protest on the 4th of January and a good turnout, just a local one, but over a dozen people. And he said, disgusted that James Costello was in prison, let alone the one that Harold Shipman was. Hypocrites. Hypocrites is a neat guest. Well, thank you so much. And a little man waving. Yeah, James Costello in jail for 5 years. For saying things on the internet. That is the state of Britain today. You know, and obviously, as I appeared on the iHypocrite Murdoch Roundup, I'm sure everything that's said in that stream will one day be played in a courtroom. And when I'm in jail for that stream, LP, how much money are you going to be sending my wife every week?
Oh, yeah. We'll cross that bridge when we come to it. Maybe who knows what the future holds? Maybe Andrew Tate will give you a cabinet position in the government. He'll make you Minister of Immigration or something like that. And everything's going to be rosy.
And well, do you know what? I don't know what link you shared to this show, but for the first night ever, we've actually got more viewers on Rumble than we have on Odyssey.
I shared the Rumble link on Twitter, yeah.
Yeah, we've got more viewers on Rumble than we have on Odyssey. And if it's your first night on Rumble, please sub me. That would be helpful. It Was Made Up gave $10. Thank you so much. Said, keep up the great work. Well, thank you very much. Stan Wong gave $14. Thank you so much. Said, question for LP. In less than 12 days' time, there is a certain presidential inauguration taking place. What major changes in the US do you foresee? And will these changes be negative or largely positive for white folk?
I mean, I don't know if there's going to be major changes. I guess that's a subjective thing. I think, you know, I'll be watching day one to see if Trump delivers on his promise to pardon the J6 protesters. That was a promise he made, as he promised to do it day one. That'll be sort of the first thing to look for, to be like, is Trump serious this time? Is he in there to make things happen? We'll find out there. I'm not that optimistic that we're going to have mass deportations as much as I wish I could say we will. Trump has a pretty good record of, on his geopolitical side, of being like a peace president. So I think on that front, we're probably going to be okay. I know Fuentes was saying that we're going to go to war with Iran under Trump or that, and obviously that's possible, but I'm cautiously optimistic that things are going to actually calm down, that he's good at negotiating in the Middle East and stuff. So I think it's weird to say, but the biggest beneficiaries may be Middle Eastern Muslims or like the Palestinian people and people like that, because he might actually be able to de-escalate what's going on there. But obviously, if he wants to actually do mass deportations in America, I'm all for it, but I'm not going to hold my breath for that either.
Well, I've already made some commentary about how disappointed I am with Trump. Now, I want to make this clear. I am super disappointed with Trump. I think there's been a number of rug pulls already. But that doesn't mean he can't surprise me and do some good things. And one thing that I am always consistent about is that people can disappoint you, then they can do something that surprises you. And with a wild card like Trump, prepare for both disappointment and surprise at different times. Now, if on his first day he pardons everyone involved in January the 6th, that would be a major surprise. But based on his recent form, I'm not holding my breath. That's the only thing I'll say. I mean, he told people to be there to support him, to stop the steal. And if he doesn't free them after basically inciting them to do it, he's a bit of an arse, to say the least. I mean, my perspective is if you call on people to do something and those people do it and they then face a legal consequence, you are some way indebted to helping them out from that position.
Yeah, pardoning those people is obviously the right and correct thing to do, and I hope that he will do it. One other thing about Trump, too, I'll add is, like I mentioned, how he's good on foreign policy. He's also good on the economy, and I'm sure the economy will improve under him, and groceries and gas will become more affordable for the average American, which for the average person, that's a really big deal. You know, that's kind of more tangible than even the immigration issue is. If you can't afford your groceries or your rent or whatever, that's a more pressing concern than whether or not your neighbors look like you. And I think Trump will do good on that. So I'm happy Trump won. I didn't want Kamala in there. There's like a lot of kind of accelerationist type talking points about how Kamala would be better. And what I would say to people was like you see what's happening in the UK where they put people in jail for memes and posting on Facebook and stuff like that. Kamala wants to do that. And Tim Walz wants to do that. I was saying to my audience, like, be careful what you wish for. You think Kamala's going to come in and the power's going to go out and it's going to be like Armageddon zombie world where you're living in the post-apocalyptic wasteland and you're going to be like chopping liberals in the head with the machete like it's The Walking Dead and it's all going to be
cool. Totally in a fantasy. We're not, yeah. Of course, he's not suggesting anyone does that in the real world now. This is hypothetical.
Well, that's the fantasy. The reality is that you're going to be in jail because of something you posted in your Telegram chat or whatever, right?
Yeah, that look, I reluctantly supported Trump from the point of view that I felt we could get more out of Trump than we could get out. There was more chance of us getting something out of Trump than ever getting anything out of Kamala. However, Trump has completely disappointed me so far, but he's got 4 years to base his entire life around pleasing me, somebody he's never heard of before. So, you know, that's that. We'll see if he does it. obviously he won't. Dare Cheruska gave $5. Thank you so much. Said, keep on fighting. Thank you very much. We usually don't answer these Odyssey Super Token tabs, but Glenn19 has given us loads of Super Chats over the years. So I'm going to make a slight exception. And he said, why would Elon Musk support Boers when he is from a wealthy Anglo family? He has more in common with other wealthy Indians that lived in his neighborhood in Pretoria than rural Boers. Most of his baby mamas are like Siobhan Zillis, are either Jews or Indians. Yeah, do you know what? We've talked a bit about women today, and I am going to get sort of probably disemboweled by my wife when I get out of here. But I've always been sort of surprised at Elon Musk's choice of women. So, like, if I was the richest man on the planet, I would never be with some sort of like weird looking skank like Grimes. You know, this guy could literally have gone on Instagram and just spent the day thumbing through the most beautiful sort of like, you know, Sports Illustrated swimsuit models. And instead he ended up with someone who looked like a, you know, spotty teenager who might cut herself in her spare time. It's an enigma to me. I don't understand it. What's going through his mind? Unless that is your thing as well. And I'm missing the point here.
I mean, if I had to guess, it's like a status thing, because she is like, she's an artsy person, right? It's like there's this cachet of coolness when you have a musician girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever. You know, I'll just say that, like, I don't really like his lifestyle in terms of his personal life. I understand, like, people like the idea of having lots of kids with lots of baby mamas. For me, I'm just a very sort of Christian approach to life. You should get married. You should have a family. You should live with your family. So I'm not like a big fan of the fact that he has so many different baby mamas, and that he seems to kind of do it with like an intentionality rather than trying to do it the right way, but it just doesn't work out every time. But you know, it is what it is. People are going to do what they want to do. And I don't know, in terms of like them being Jews and Indians, I honestly don't know that much about his baby mamas to have an opinion on that.
Okay, look, I find it strange, and I've just always thought, you know, I mean, I agree with you. I'm a, you know, one woman guy, obviously. That's what we were sort of joking earlier. And you know, I believe in the traditional family. I think the traditional family, as I said in my book, is the bedrock of society, and it should be one man, one woman, and children. And once you form that family unit, you should be together for life, and you know, you should raise those children in a healthy environment. But obviously, you know, if I was a single billionaire, you know, coming through the sort of, the girls of Instagram, I wouldn't be, you know, sliding into Grimes's DMs. I'd be aiming a lot higher. That's all I'm saying.
Do you want to name any names? Who are we talking about here?
I don't know.
I'm sure your wife would love to hear who you would be hitting on if you were a billionaire.
Well, no, but this is the thing. This is the thing, right? I'm not allowed on Instagram, so I couldn't give you any names. But I was on Instagram at one point, and I can tell you now that beautiful women in bikinis that were, you know, infinitely more attractive than Grimes were like 10 a penny. You know, and these weren't women that would have been high maintenance. These were women that, like, you know, if you had a bit of money and you plucked them out of obscurity, they'd be like the happiest person alive to be, sit on your yacht, look pretty, and bear you alpha children. You know what I mean? That's how the world works. You never see one of these Russian billionaires with a freak, do you? They're always just if you've got to give one thing to fat Russian billionaires who earn mega yachts, they make good choices when it comes to women.
I was going to say, are you a Sydney Sweeney fan? Because I know she's kind of the it girl right these days.
No. No, I'm not. I'm trying to think of somebody now that I could say, but if I say a name, it's going to be memed into oblivion, isn't it? And people will just say how out of my league she is, and just, you know, that there would be literally no chance ever. And then, I'm opening myself up here to vast ridicule. So I'm not going down that road. That's it. I'm drawing the line. I'm just saying it wouldn't be Grimes. Like, you know, if Grimes is here, the bird I was picking would be sort of here or above there. You know, that's what I'm saying.
Enough said. Got it.
You're trying to get me killed tonight. LP, $3 comes from Appalachia Invicta. Thank you so much. He said, LP gets harassed by antisocial autists over his mic volume on his own channel. Comes on PDBR and gets poked by PA Chads and Mark about his mic volume. Lol. I'm really sorry about that. Your mic volume was fine. We sorted the volumes before the show, and it's been cool. So it was just that one moment when it went weird. So my apologies. You are that guy.
I said ban that guy, whoever sent that super chat.
No, I'm not banning anyone that sends a super chat. Like, you know, Mycroft Wins gave an insanely generous $188.24. Thank you so much. Yeah. Thank you so much, my friend. You've turned this financial metrics of this stream around. So I can't thank you enough. He says nothing to add, just sending some love. Well, look, thank you very much. And like I say to all the regular super chatters, you are all welcome, you know, to write to me. And I mean this, right? This is a big pledge, but I do mean this. If you're a regular super chatter and you regularly contribute, you know, even if it's small contributions, but you contribute week in, week out, or if you've done one-off large contributions, you know, you are always welcome to email me, speak to me, talk to me about things like that. And, you know, there are people who send super chats from outside the country and they visit the UK and they come and meet me and I take them out for dinner. I've done that before. And I am genuinely grateful to all you guys. So if any of you ever, you know, want to do that, give me a shout. And, you know, I am here. And I do genuinely appreciate it from the bottom of my heart. So thank you so much. British Gammon gave $25. He's also very, very generous. And you know where to find me, British Gammon. You're a good man. And I know that he is a stand-up guy. And he said, Labour deleted a post on their official TikTok account as the lyrics to the soundtrack described drugging and abusing young girls. Do you think this was a careless error? Or is the Labour regime pure evil? I'll tell you what that was, or what I think it was. I think it's them being completely out of touch. But I also think it's them showing a total sort of disregard towards the people who really glorify the problems in society. So Labour will try to tell you that a stream like this needs shutting down. Someone like me needs to be prosecuted. They need to pass new laws to come and get me. You know, they will tell you that. But at the same time, they will happily, you know, use a song which talks about drugging and raping girls because they don't think that's a problem. That's not a problem to them. The problem to these people, the people like me, the people talking about the drugging and raping of girls, that's how mixed up everything is.
Oh, so this was the post with the I saw this video with the animals, but I didn't pick up on that the song was that. Yeah, I, you know, when I was younger and more naive, I used to not read too much into stuff like that and think it's probably an honest mistake. It's probably, as I've gotten older and I've gotten to know the world better and people better, when I see something like that, I think, yeah, probably whoever did that wasn't I don't know if I would say evil, maybe, but maybe just some like libtard who thought it would be funny to push people's buttons. You know, a lot of times these people, they just, it's like they just can't wrap their head around how serious some of this stuff is, you know, and it's not necessarily like, but that they like, they don't, it's almost like they don't know what they're doing, but they're still doing it intentionally, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I think these are difficult ones. I think these are difficult ones because there is the sort of thought process where you're thinking they've done that on purpose. This is them giving a nod. But at the same time, you can imagine some.
Well, the song was in Portuguese too. Sorry to interrupt, but I'm just like, I pulled, because I wasn't really that familiar with the context. So the song was in Portuguese and somebody had to translate the lyrics. And so it's possible they didn't even know what they were doing.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the problem is you can imagine some clueless multicultural intern would have done something like this. But, you know, who knows? I mean, but one thing we do know is they are evil. And whether this was an act of intentional evil or an act of stupidity by someone supporting an evil regime, I suppose is by the by. You know, it's all part of the same package, which is a package we need to remove if we're going to survive. $25 came from Poit. Thank you so much. He said donation. Well, thank you very much for your continued support. And Appalachia Invicta gave another $5. He was going to be banned earlier. That was the man you were going to ban. Look, he dropped
I was $5. Joking. That's kind of I have my channel. It's kind of a running joke where if people complain about the audio from the live chat, I ban them.
The thing is, what I've noticed about you over the night is, number one, you are very easy to talk to, and I'd actually like to get you on something like a lighthearted gaming stream or a movie review night, because I think you do very well on that. But I have noticed your mic is like, it has two zones. You're either in the perfect zone when you're about this far from it, but if you go a little bit closer or a little bit further away, everything starts to break up. And it's kind of like, I want to sit by the side of you and just hold your head. And if you start, you know, like, if you start sort of straying, I'm like, give you a quick slap, and you're like, oh yeah, sorry, I've got to be in that Goldilocks zone. You know, when you're in the Goldilocks zone, you sound great. When you're not in the Goldilocks zone, do you game? I was going to ask you, do you game?
Oh yeah, I game big. I don't play PUBG, so I would get I would just be an embarrassment at that. But I do game, yeah.
I'll read the rest of this donation, and then I'll tell you my secret shame. It's from Appalachia in Victory, gave $5. Thank you so much. Said, toss this in the war chest and reclaim our island. I am doing my best, my friend. So this is my secret shame. Over the last couple of days, well, towards the end of the Christmas break, I discovered a game called Mario Super Picross that only came out in America on the Super Famicom. And it's basically a puzzle game that's like a Sudoku, but instead of it being a Sudoku, it's a picture, and you have to uncover the picture via lines of numbers that correlate to points on a grid. And it sounds really crap. It sounds really crap, but it's the most addictive thing imaginable. And once I started solving these little puzzles, the first night I played it, it was during the Christmas break, so I'd had a little bit of a lie-in, and I ended up looking at the clock, and it was like past midnight, which is unthinkable for me. And I was like, what am I doing? And I was just trying to solve these. And I do love those books of Sudokus, and I really, you know, I enjoy, I used to enjoy crosswords, actually. And this is like that, but with, you know, it's a numerical puzzle that helps you uncover a picture. And if people have played this, it's got many, many different names. It's like, it's called Mario Super Picross on the Super Famicom. It's called Mario's Picross on the Game Boy. It was a Japanese only release, so it never came out in North America, and I'm playing a translated like pirate ROM, but It's so engaging. And apparently I asked my missus about this, and she said, yeah, you can get it on like iPhone and stuff, but it's called Nonograms, and there's many different names for them. But if you look this up and you like, you don't have to play it on like a Nintendo, there's loads of versions of it, like, but if you like sort of really engaging numerical puzzles, this just blows your mind. But it's like a high IQ thing. If you're somebody that just doesn't like puzzles, or puzzles fry your head, you won't be able to do it. So what are you game on then? What's your game?
Puzzles. I play Magic the Gathering online. That's one of my like go tos. I play.
So you are basically an Ubersberg.
Yeah, Civilization, you know,
stuff, yes.
Stuff like that. Something I do with my audience sometimes, I'll have like these gaming stream nights where we play the Jackbox games. I don't know if you're familiar with those.
What are those?
They're sort of like trivia-ish, or they're like party games. Like the one I really like is called Fibbage, and it's what they do is they ask you a trivia question that like nobody would realistically know the answer to, and you have to lie and make up a fake answer, and then after everybody's put in that, then everyone picks what they think is the correct answer, and so if people pick your lie, you get points, and that's a really fun game.
Well, if you ever do a gaming night and you're looking for a panel like you've done, I'm not pressuring you, but obviously if you ever do anything like the Murdoch thing with gaming, I would absolutely love to do that with you. And, you know, I'd be more than happy to jump on. You know, I like retro gaming, I like modern gaming, but yeah, it's that'd be something I'd love to join you on that. So, and that sounds really, really good. I'm a bit of a retro gamer myself, and you know, I like my retro gaming, but that sounds brilliant. And if you ever did anything like that, you know, I'd love to join you. Anyway, Aunt Sally gave $5. Thank you so much for your continued support. She said, thank you, Mark, and I, Hypocrite. Thank you very much. VM gave $10. Thank you very much. And said, do you enjoy seeing quality memes at the top of my X feed, thanks to I, Hypocrite? Remember, when Elon does his I'm shocked quote treats, to not clap like seals and put your feet back, because Daddy Elon will fix everything. Keep him on the back foot until he unbans the very people warning about it. 14. Yeah, I mean, he did unban me, but then he rebanned me, and I'm pretty sure it was a British government thing. I'm sure the British government wrote to him or somebody.
Yeah, hope, you know, not hate or somebody like that.
No, yeah. I don't think it would be hope not hate. I think it'll be I think there are several groups that governments of Western countries were really bothered by. Like, one was the NJP. They did the same to all the NJP accounts, and, you know, it's right. Disappointing, because I had a really big Twitter account at its peak. It had 60,000 followers, and that was back in the old days when I was basically shadow banned. And I'm pretty right. sure that if I was unlocked, I'd be well over 100,000 now, and, you know, definitely. Enjoying myself. And Twitter Spaces are fantastic as well, because they reach so many people.
Yeah, there is a really kind of, you know, sad irony that he's tweeting about these grooming gangs. Meanwhile, somebody who was like at the forefront of blowing the whistle on this 20 years ago, 2004, yeah. 20 years ago, you were trying to tell people about this, but you're not allowed on the platform, and that's part of why. That's part of why the government hates you, right? So
yeah.
So yeah,
I was persecuted for it, taken to court, had my house raided, sat in a police cell, you know, went through the ringer, and it took a huge toll on me at the time. And I look back on it now and think to myself, you know, it feels like ancient history, but it was, you know, it was big at the time. And, somebody's asked, is there an FPS game where you get to use an explosive drone? Yes, there is. I think you can use drones in all kinds of Call of Duty games, can't you? It's like a kill streak. If you as a perk, you can use a drone. So yes, there are games where you can use drones. So yeah.
The last super chatter, don't let up the pressure on Musk. That I think he's right. I think we need to put pressure on him. We need to put pressure on him to unban all these accounts. You mentioned a bunch of them earlier. Unfortunately, Musk doesn't pay any attention to me. Like, he doesn't interact with me at all, despite my big account. But I will try to fire off a few tweets to say, like, hey, look at all these people who are still banned. Can we do something here? Because it is hypocritical. Mm-hmm. If he wants to complain about the grooming gangs being this terrible thing, it's not right that you don't get a Twitter account.
No, exactly. Exactly. I mean, you know, and he's bigging up Tommy Robinson as well as like the man that exposed it, which just, you know, I'm not saying Tommy Robinson doesn't deserve any credit, but, you know, it kind of just like sticks in my craw a little bit when I went through so much. And yeah. Tommy Robinson has never actually been prosecuted for speech crimes. It's always been for contempt of court, whereas mine literally was a speech crime. It was for making speeches at political meetings, asking people to organize and stand as candidates and campaign electorally to raise the issue of grooming gangs and to get people elected so we could raise this issue at a higher level and call for things like an inquiry and prosecutions of those involved. You know, people are asking, is Sam Melia out of prison? Yeah, he was out before Christmas. We've posted on social media about that. Saturn5 gave $3. Thanks so much. He said, hi, guys. Why do ethno-nationalists scoff at Bitcoin so much when it's a sound alternative to fiat handed to them on a silver platter? I'm all for Bitcoin. And if you've got lots of it but don't understand it or don't like it, you can send it to me and I'll look after it for you.
Yeah, I've got some Bitcoin. I don't have anything against Bitcoin. I'm a little bit standoffish with crypto in general, but Bitcoin is kind of one of the exceptions there, where it is a fairly solid investment. And I also like the stable coins as well, just as a way to move money around. That's a little bit less, not that I'm trying to avoid being traced, but I'm just saying for people who want to donate anonymously and stuff like that, that crypto is a great system. I don't think a lot of nationalists are really down on it. I think I do see, like, in the sort of some of the Christian circles, that people are down on the idea of trying to get rich off of these meme coins and these crypto coins, that it's kind of like a, you know, just a shortcut to where you're not really producing anything or doing. But, you know, hey, man, if you get rich, good for you. I'm not going to hold it against you.
Look, this is the way I see it. I think people who produce good content and do good work deserve to be remunerated for it. Now, I don't know really, other than a couple of people like Tommy Robinson, I don't know anyone that's got rich off nationalism. And most people that have managed to make a living off being a nationalist have done so probably at a level beneath what they would have done in the open market had they pursued a normal career, because they're quite intelligent people.
Yeah.
And what's more, when you balance what nationalist leaders earn and you compare that to what leaders of mainstream political parties get, and then throw in the fact that nationalist leaders constantly have the sword of Damocles hanging above their head and can get arrested at any time and thrown in the gulag, you know, the people who are sort of saying, yeah, you're getting rich and it's all a grift and you're making millions when you're clearly not. It's you know, it's one of the things. I tend to find that people who make the biggest noise about, you know, about people who are just doing their best to keep their head above water, being grifters, you know, the people saying that are usually anonymous trolls that are probably operating out of a, you know, a well air-conditioned office block in Israel. You know, they're in Tel Aviv, yeah. And they're like, yes, this guy telling the truth about Israel, he just got a $5 donation. What a grifter. You know, it's probably a bit of a disinformation tactic, to be honest. Anyway, Space Kang gave $5. Thank you so much. And said, thanks for holding it down in the UK. Trump is going to liberate you one day. Just kidding. We need a King Mark, though. I would be a good king. I'd be very entertaining. And as I said, the queen would not be Grimes. So, yeah. Eye candy all around. So eye candy. I've just realized as well that if I did reel off some sort of perfect Instagram influencer, like as like the woman that I would go for, everyone would be absolutely disgusted about my taste in women. They'd just be like, Mark, they would just be like, oh my God, she's a fake bimbo. How could you possibly do that or something? And I'd probably get dragged for the next 6 weeks and mocked in the commentary. But yeah,
you can't win.
No, but King Mark has got good taste. You see, as a king, I'd also be good because I don't indulge in any smoking, alcohol, drugs, sort of binge eating or anything like that. So I'd be very, very level headed and committed to it. I think that's what's kept me going in nationalism, actually, that I tend to be quite level headed because I don't like nationalists who end up getting into, you know, stressful positions but have a tendency to sort of take substances. They're the ones that tend to be hit the hardest because they sort of spiral. I think to do this long term, you have to be grounded. And it's interesting because Sam Melia said the same about being in prison. He said that when he was in prison, it was sort of easier on him because he wasn't somebody struggling with addiction problems, where the people who struggle with addiction problems in prison become sort of prey to people who can supply them with their vices.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah,
I don't have any vices.
I did in my youth, but not so much. I keep it pretty straight edge these days, maybe a beer here and there, you know?
Yeah, I don't have any. I don't really have any vices. There's nothing, like if you said to me, right, Mark, you need, you know, I'll deny you this. I won't be really crawling up the wall. Like, even if you took my Red Bull away from me, I'd probably just, you know, make a couple of extra cups of tea a day and put a couple of sugars in them. You know what I mean? That'd just be, or you know, maybe drink a little bit more coffee or something like that. You know, I never drink coffee, but I'd probably just sort of substitute it for coffee. I don't think there's anything in my life I could, you know, that you could sort of, you know, leverage over me like that. You know,
What if we take away your PUBG?
I could live without PUBG as well. As I said, I don't think, other than my wife and daughter, I don't think there's anything you could take away from me that would cause me to melt down. Like, even if you said to me, right, you know, the government have mandated that you can't live in your house and you've just got to fill a bag and put on your warmest clothes and sleep on the streets. I suppose I'd survive. You know, it'd be a bit of an adventure for the first couple of nights. You know, you just have to take it as it came.
Yeah, I do kind of think of my gaming as a vice, although I really don't do it in a problematic way anymore. But in my past, there have been times where it's like I was gaming too much. When I was younger, I would smoke weed every day and play video games. And it's just kind of like, yeah,
smoking
it's like
a waste.
And it's terrible. So I always tell people, like, don't do it. You're just like, you don't realize how much of your life is just slipping by while you're in this haze of weed and video games. So yeah, I dropped the weed a while ago. I still kept the video games, but I keep it to like 1 or 2 hours a day, which I think is reasonable. I like to tell myself that anyways.
I'm so addicted to Mario's Picross that I've been playing it during this show and ignoring most of what you said. I just got nodding blind. No, I'm only joking. You'd know if I was playing like a tough video game while we were talking, because every now and again I'd sort of swear. Yeah. What's wrong with you, mate? You got that facial tick. Are you gaming? Somebody in the chat, Tony Churchill, said, I used to drink vodka for breakfast, but I'm 7 months sober now. Well, well done, my friend. Keep it up, and thumbs up from us. And today we've also got, you've brought the super chats over to Rumble. We regularly don't get Rumble super chats. We've got a few. Sir Thomas Drake gave 5. Thank you so much. And said shekels for good guys. Thank you very much. Standing while pooping. Is that even possible? Well, I mean, it is possible, but
I'm recognizing all these names. They're people from my who super chat my show. Yeah, Sir Thomas.
Well, thank you so much. He said, "Great show. LP is the goat. Little man with arm in air." Well, thank you so much. And Ghost Dog Man gave 5. Thank you so much. Said locking in my down payment for the holiday with Mark Collett. Promise.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. The copers coming through. That's what I call my audience, the copers.
Well, one thing that I always found quite frustrating at one time during my sort of history and nationalism is people didn't like sort of a lighthearted discussion. And tonight, I think we've talked a lot about a lot of really hard hitting things. You know, we talked about the grooming scandal, mass immigration, you know, replacement of white people. We've talked about Trump. We've talked about January the 6th. We've talked about the Brov Party, the effect of people like Andrew Tate on young urban white youth. And there's been stuff that we've covered that's really good. But I do also think it is important to talk about normal things. You know, you've talked about weed. We've talked about, you know, video games, things we enjoy. And I do think it's important to balance that. And I will say this, when I was on Twitter, you know, you were somebody I followed, and I always found your memes and your tweets, you know, they are obviously deeply political, but they're also engaging, and you do balance things with a very relatable and sort of lighthearted way. So you're instantly likable. Like if somebody said to me, look, Mark, you are going to be king tomorrow. Who's coming to Buckingham Palace for the party? You would be on the list. You'd be a good party guest.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Are you good at Mario Kart?
I mean, it's been a minute since I played any Mario Kart. I used to, you know, back in the day, I used to do okay, I guess.
You see, I am a bad loser, so as king, I might be quite dangerous. You know, somebody beats me at Mario Kart and makes one joke too many. You know, they're carted off to Tower Bridge to meet the purveyors of the grooming gangs and share their fate. Oh, sorry, he just got mixed up because of the Mario Kart. Off with his head. But no, I would definitely, you're definitely somebody who is one of the most engaging content creators, and you've really, really prospered. Do you have sort of a secret, though, to your success? Or is it just being addicted to Twitter and immersing yourself and being on the pulse?
It's partly that. I guess my guiding principle is to just post and talk about things that I personally find interesting, right? Sometimes you post something or you talk about something and it gets a lot of traction, and there's a temptation to be like, oh, I need to do more of this. But I try to avoid chasing engagement and just do the stuff I actually like. And that generally works out pretty good. Obviously I do some engagement baiting on Twitter. But and especially when it comes to like my video content, I really try to like keep it to like, is this a video that I would want to watch, you know? And that seems to have worked out pretty decently. I mean, I don't think of myself as like a big creator or a big deal. So it's a little bit, you know, I don't really like being flattered. So hearing you talk about like, I'm a big guest and I'm kind of like, I'm really not nothing special. But I guess, well,
No, I mean, back in the day, I was sort of 100,000 YouTube man and, you know, I was doing well on Twitter. And obviously my star to some degree has fallen due to the fact that I've been so aggressively snuffed out on every platform. And, you know, in comparison, you have risen from strength to strength. I'm not kissing your ass. I'm just saying it's true. You've got the knack of getting people to notice. And, you know, I had a very specific way of writing a video script that worked really well on YouTube because it was tailored at sort of bringing in normies and curious people. And that method of writing a video script doesn't work as well in an online echo chamber like Odyssey, you know, so it's death to my views there. But yeah, you've done really well. And I think you deserve, you know, credit for it. And it's not a matter of just blowing you up. It's just sort of, you know, it's interesting how some people can get onto a platform and really capture the zeitgeist. And other people try so hard to do that. And they've got 35 followers, but 35,000 tweets. And you don't know where it went wrong. Yeah. And you're the opposite way around.
There's just a luck factor, too. I'm just a little bit lucky. Like, I haven't had organizations like the ADL and SPLC come out. They certainly could. They're certainly, you could put together like a clip compilation of some of the spiciest things I've said, and it wouldn't be a great look to the average normie, but I've just kind of managed to stay off the radar. I don't know if it's because they just see me as a joker or what, but I've been a little bit lucky in that I haven't faced that level of pressure. Like I was banned from YouTube twice, but I was able to get my channel reinstated. But and I've gotten like a lot of strikes over the years, but I've managed to avoid losing it altogether. And so there's a little bit of luck involved there.
Yeah, because when my channel got taken down, I didn't have a single strike or any notifications. The whole thing was just wiped in one go. I think the same happened to people like Keith Woods. We've got another super chat here from Titan over on Rumble. Thank you so much. You get $50.
Another Cooper. Hey, those are supposed to go to me. What are you doing? They're good guys.
But you can't say that. he sat here laughing uncomfortably as all of his supporters give me their money. And now he's like, shouldn't have done this.
Oh, it's great. I'm glad they showed up.
Well, thank you so much, guys. It's been really good. And look, we've got about 5 minutes left of the show. It's been an amazing, really fun show. And I've got my show 300 coming up, and we're going to have a lot of guests coming on for 10-minute slots. So if you're free for 10 minutes and you'd like to join us, you know, come on. It's in 5 weeks' time. If you're willing, I'll send you a booking form because I've got to get everyone in the right time slots. But before we go, what are your hopes for 2025? And what do you think is a... You know, let's say a couple of predictions, you know, maybe your hopes and one good prediction and one bad prediction for 2025.
You know, I already kind of touched on how I think things are headed in the right direction. And so the plan for me is to just keep up the fight, keep the pressure on, try to keep the momentum, whatever little momentum we have built over the last few years. I'm like, on a personal note, I'm getting more involved in my faith with Jesus. I don't talk about this a lot, but it's like I'm taking it more seriously. I'm trying to spend more time reading the Bible, doing Bible studies and stuff like that. So that's sort of one of my personal goals for the year, is to learn my religion better and be a better you know, advocate for it or whatever. I really do believe in the power of Jesus, and I'd love to try to bring some people over to his light if possible. So that's something I'll be trying to do. As far as predictions, man, I don't know. Andrew Tate PM of the UK, Mark Collette, his main man, put in charge of immigration. No, I don't know. Who knows what's going to happen? I don't know. What do you think? What are your predictions? You tell me.
I think we're going to see an increasing move towards sort of a CivNat kind of, you know, alt-like position with these Trumps, your Farages, your AFDs. And I think a lot of people are going to be hoping for some kind of big remigration, but I think they're going to be disappointed. I think there's going to be a shift, but I don't think it's going to be the seismic shift our people are hoping for. And you know what? I'm really interested in you talking about your Christianity, etc. And I'm open to stuff like that. I do find people's personal journeys interesting. And I think, you know, I think that's a good thing. And are you indulging in that with your wife and children? Are they along with the ride? Do you go to church?
Yeah, we go to church just about every week, unless someone's sick or something like that. I owe it to my wife. I was starting to become more open-minded a bit about it before I met her, but it was really because she's a lifelong Christian, and then getting to know her and getting to know her family and seeing what amazing people they are made me think, you know, maybe there's something to this. And then it's hard to describe, but eventually at a certain point, your faith becomes real and it grows stronger. And you're like, oh, God is real. Jesus is real. I actually believe in this. I never thought I would. And it's very, very good feeling. You know, there's a lot to like in the religion when you realize like, oh, what, I'm going to be saved. I'm going to go to paradise. Like, God cares about me. I don't talk about it a lot because in the nationalist circles, it's kind of a controversial thing. A lot of people view Christianity as a weakness. They think it's holding us back. And so it's hard to talk about without getting those comments, which I don't really personally want to deal with. But I am going to be, by the looks of it, hosting an interesting discussion in the next few days. I don't know exactly when. It looks like maybe Friday. But between E. Michael Jones and Corey Mahler from the Stone Choir podcast, they've both agreed to it. We're just trying to pin down the time. And the topic of that discussion will be, is white unity compatible with Christianity? And so that's going to be an interesting discussion that I'm looking forward to.
Well, that's very interesting. You know what? It's a shame the show's coming to an end now, but I will say this. When we see Christianity, and I was discussing this with somebody the other day, and you look at Christianity and people say, oh, it's a global religion. It takes in people of all colors and all cultures, etc., blah, 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 and all that nonsense. I disagree. And the reason I disagree is because if you go around England and you go to any of the historic churches and you look at the architecture, the artwork, the artistry of things like the hymn books, you know, the song, the instruments, everything that church was, it was all an expression of European brilliance. It wasn't an expression of anyone else's culture or any other racial group's way of life. It was the best stonemasons of that village, the best carpenters, the best artists, you know, the best sculptors, and they produced something that was amazing. But it was distinctly European. And if you'd taken Christianity to somewhere like Africa, they wouldn't have produced York Minster or St. Paul's Cathedral or the Trevi Fountain. You know, they would have produced something that was absolutely different. So when you see the expression of Christianity in the West and you marvel at it, that is an expression of white brilliance that was inspired in some way by Christian scripture. But the fact is, you can't have that brilliance without white people. So what I'm saying is I have this difference of opinion with E. Michael Jones, because he said the religion came first and the race stuff came second. And I was like, right. No, the race stuff comes first, because you could give Christianity to Africa and they wouldn't produce, you know.
And we have, like, Uganda is very Christian and it doesn't look like the, you know, where the UK or France or anything like that. Yeah, no, I agree. I respect E. Michael Jones a lot. He's a smart guy, but I also disagree with him on that position. And you're absolutely right. And I think Corey Mahler, the other guy who's going to be on the discussion, his viewpoint is not just that, like, there's nothing incompatible about white unity or white nationalism with Christian nationalism. But even more than that, it's almost like white people are the stewards of Christianity on this world. It wouldn't be the global religion that it is if it weren't for white people.
Well, look, I've often thought of it like this. And let's take the African thing out of it, because they never created even two-story buildings in sub-Saharan Africa. But let's say Christianity had first gone to Japan and taken hold in Japan rather than in Europe. Our idea of a church would be fundamentally different to what it is today. The way a church was built, the way you walked into a church, the music of the church, the traditional dress, it would be completely different. And all of those things that I've just said, like the way you go into a church, you know, the spires, the architecture, even things like the gargoyles, you know, that adorn, you know, traditional churches in villages all over Britain, they're all steeped in European folklore, culture, and it's a merging of scripture and ancient, you know, European practices. And I can't see why some people can't see that those two things came together and brought what they did. I don't see them as separate, is what I'm saying. I see them as something that, you know, has come together. Like Christmas. We were talking before the show about what it was to have a family Christmas. Well, the Christmas tree predated, you know, the European Christmas tree predated Christianity in Europe. And Christmas as a holiday in Europe is obviously a merging of, you know, Christmas and, you know, Yuletide and, you know, winter solstice. And as I said, why have you brought up this bloody issue now? We could have done a 2-hour show on this, man. I've got a mind to make this guy sit here for another hour and explain himself. Bloody hell. The 5 minutes over now and we're just getting to the fire. Look, I've really enjoyed this, mate, and I'm not going to keep you any longer, but an interesting topic, and I'll be interested in watching the stream. But you and I should do something like this again, and I'd love to talk to you more, because it has been a really good show. I've really enjoyed it. It's been very relaxed. So I want to thank iHypocrite for being here. I also want to thank everyone who's donated so generously. Thank you so much from the bottom of my heart. And also, huge thank you to the whole audience. You know, we've had nearly 500 people watching across all platforms tonight. I'm really happy with that. For the first time ever, Rumble has beaten out all platforms. It's been a great night. I want to thank you all. Lots of love to you. And I'll see you same time next week. I don't know who the guest is going to be yet. So thanks so much, iHypocrite. And let's wrap things up. Thank you, everyone.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, thank you, everyone. Have a great night. I'll see you again soon. Check in on my video on Friday, and I'll see you again next week for another episode of Patriotic Weekly Review. Thank you, everybody, and good night.